Sure, y'all come on in, take your shoes off, sit on down.
Y'all listening to
In the Corner, back by the woodpile.
I'm Spunk Counter Guy, thanks for coming by. Most of the time that I'm recording these podcasts, I'm doing so in the Middle Tennessee region, which has the highest Kurdish population in the U.S. The Kurds have been coming to in and around Nashville since the 1970s, but their numbers greatly increased during the late 80s and up until the Iraq War in 2003. Historically, there's much debate as to the origins of the Kurdish people, some believing that there are records of their civilization as far back as the 4th century BC. But what is known is that today, they are a people that have populations largely in Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq, and having no official homeland, have suffered greatly in the past few centuries. During Saddam Hussein's reign alone, estimates range upwards of 200,000 Kurdish individuals being exterminated, mostly via chemical weapons. More recently, the Kurds have been one of the few entities to hold the ISIS forces at bay, with little to no help from outsiders. But beyond these horrific tragedies, the Kurds have a rich culture and unique history. I had wanted to conduct a podcast that dealt specifically with these elements of Kurdish heritage, but my guest, Nabız Kader, whom I'd intended to introduce us to the Kurdish existence, had such a great life story of his own, especially his days as a translator for U.S. troops during the Iraq War. We ended up spending most of our time on that. We started first by talking about Mr. Kader's younger days in Iraq.
Growing up, did you live in a purely Kurdish area?
No, that's why I'm bilingual. I lived with Turkmen and I lived with Arab too.
Okay, and this was up in the north?
Right. This was in Kirkuk.
Kirkuk, which is almost north. Almost north, okay.
Yeah. When I grew up, I remember like always before going to sleep, my mom or dad, they telling you like this story about there's a wolf and there's a sheep and the wolf always trying to attack the sheep. Uh-huh. It's kind of, sometimes kind of, if I think about it right now, it's terrifying. You don't want to tell your kids that.
Well, yeah.
But back in the days, it was like that, so...
Can you tell the whole story real quick?
The whole story is just this sheep, and there's a baby sheep going kind of away from the herd. Uh-huh. Yeah, and there's the wolf kind of watch them, and then the baby sheep goes there, and he tries to eat the baby sheep. Then the others comes to defend him, and the wolf gonna run away. And back then, it didn't tell me, but right now I realize it's just like it's kind of message. If you have a unity, your enemy cannot defeat it, right? Like beat you or defeat
okay
you.
Yeah, that's a common
yeah
many cultures have a similar
thing. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because sometimes unity in culture might mean everybody has to do with what one person says.
Yes.
So the Kurds again seemed to me, from a casual observer, seem to be very fluid. Like they seem to be very tolerant of different opinions.
That's
true. And yet they are very unified.
That's right.
How did that happen?
I feel like we've been under pressure from Saddam, or even before that. We do not want to be under influence on one person and we do whatever that person says or wants.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that you see too many political parties in that small region. We have a communist parties, we have in between, and we have Islamic parties, and we have even atheist parties too.
Are they civil? I mean, do they...
Oh, yeah.
So they're not trying to...
No. They're see, right now, it's like a political war, like everyone wanna serve or show the people what's their plan, what's their solution to the country to gain more votes in the end of the road and be in the power. Because I believe the time of war or fighting each other gone, and people would not even want to go through that again.
And then we got to the years when Saddam Hussein, not a fan of the Kurds, was the dictator of Iraq.
One of the things I remember, my mom, she was telling me I was a teenager, she was like, don't never talk about the government with anyone. Uh-huh. Don't say nothing, because she told me we used to live in a small town next to Kirkuk, and this guy was having a cart and selling veggies on the cart, and he was complaining, just in the market, he was like, this is not alive, we don't even have a power at home, it's very cold in the winter. The Saddam's guys, there was the bath party, they took that guy in that town and they put him in a room just like 2x2 and heated with the heater till about he was about to die, and they took him out. Or like, do you dare next time to say there's no power? That heater came from the power.
Wow.
So it was very terrifying and scary. Like it reached to a point, parents cannot talk about Saddam at home. They afraid that a kid would go outside and talk with his his friends like that, and the other kid would go to tell their parents. So
During the Saddam years, do you feel like, cause, I mean, a lot of countries in the Middle East, they're ahead of the game on technology, but so Iraq was behind.
Yes.
And was that because of his mismanagement or just...
It because of his mismanagement and mistreatment to the whole country.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it was not like, as I said, people did not, we were suffering to find a food to eat, in, especially in 90s.
Okay, so the last thing on their mind was computers, yeah.
Yeah, in the sanction time, I remember I grew up with, like, in the mornings, my breakfast, especially when you're on a teenage, or you just like in the time when you grow up, your body changing, you need to eat good nutrition. Like, I remember all I was eating in the mornings, one in the Kurdish cups, they are really maybe 1-2 ounces like of tea with a bread. That's it.
Like a little piece of bread.
Yeah, you would be blessed if you got some kind of yogurt, like a plain yogurt, or maybe a cheese, or...
Man.
Yeah.
So you're hungry most of the day.
Yes, and there was no jobs. Like, my dad, he was a English teacher, and he was one of the bit, like, I can tell, one of the best teachers in the town. He was well known, and he was a cab driver after war, because Saddam was paying him whole month $3, whole month.
Wow.
Teaching. And Saddam could pay him way more than that, but
it all went to his palace, huh?
To his palace and to weapons.
Yes, yeah.
To weapons, because when U.S. Army, I think we're going back and forth, but just when the U.S. Army went to the palaces, there was just like, even the faucets were gold, pure gold. That's despite of how much gold they found, they blocks,
right,
and money, and all those
وكون يكون كنا جرقم لتاو هجران تومويا بسوزي نيد سوتيمو بناغمي نيد نالين
We had started to talk about other countries and how they have mistreated or neglected the Kurds a lot of times. And I think about America a little bit because that's what I know the best. And I know that, like, during the, in 1988,
yes,
when Saddam had...
Anfal operation, right, and the chemical attack.
Right. There was politicians, not only just in America, but, you know...
In whole the world.
The United Nations.
In United Nations and in West overall.
Right.
Because there's a human rights, or at least there's a name of human rights in West, which is I'm proud of it, and it's glad to be here. But I don't know why back then nobody like cared, and nobody was like even like talked about it, or I don't know why people kind of kept it secret or kept it not to be obvious to the public.
Right.
And I feel, again, it goes back to the politics.
Right.
I
know at that time, Saddam was technically America's ally against Iran.
Right, against Iran. And that's the whole story. Right. And that's why I personally don't like politics.
Right.
Because It's my personal opinion, personal view. Uh-huh. I don't trust the politics because there's no, when it reaches to a point, there's no emotions. And maybe I am wrong, but from what I have uh-huh. seen in my life, sometimes it reaches to a point, there's no humanity, there's mm-hmm. no friends in politics.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think, and this is just true of any kind of politics, and human rights becomes a political football, I feel.
Exactly.
And sometimes the underdogs will be helped out if it's politically, there's some advantage to it.
Exactly.
You know? And I think about, I still remember in Nashville when there was initial talks of going to Iraq for the war during the second Bush presidency. And you had, of course, the anti-war people. You weren't here during that time, but they were saying that, even to the point, like, the Kurds are liars. And then there was a rally on the opposition, I think at the Parthenon.
Okay.
And there were Kurds there who had, you know, escaped, and they were telling their stories. And it was just an amazing contrast. But then I think now maybe some people are ashamed that they had said the Kurds are liars, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
It depends if people don't know a lot of Americans, if they didn't know, and I'm sure they didn't,
yeah,
about what's going on in that region or mm-hmm. on that part of the world, they would not believe it in a matter mm-hmm. of a day or two.
Yeah.
On why would I send my brother or son to be killed there? So
sure,
it kind of makes sense to some right. people too, but there's always politicians, they use that as a card,
right,
as a playing card.
Right. I think what really punched me in the head, or heart, I should say, maybe, is a friend of mine who teaches special needs in Davidson County.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her students had been in the womb, was a Kurd, had been in the womb when Saddam had dropped chemicals on that village. And so it was handicapped because of the, you know, and I think the mom was in bad shape too, you know. So that was the first I really ended up on my radar. I was like, man.
Right.
Next, Nabaz's gig as a translator for the U.S. Army.
In the beginning of the Iraqi Operation Freedom, I was working with the airborne units mm-hmm. in Saddam's palaces in his town, hometown, Tikrit.
Tikrit, uh-huh.
Yes, I was in Tikrit.
Now, had he been found yet?
No. Back then, I was living in a small town in Tuz, uh-huh. which is south of Kirkuk. So I was going back and forth. I wasn't a student. I just graduated and mm-hmm. have money to even have a car.
Okay.
So I was going to the, like, let's say, bus station, mm-hmm. which we call it over the garage, to take these minivans, uh-huh. go back and forth every single day to Tikrit, uh-huh. hour and a half, to work to the military base or the palace.
The little vans are the transit system, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the same most of the Africa and other places.
The interesting thing about it, like back then, people were very, even in Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, mm-hmm. the U.S. Army were welcomed there.
Really?
Yeah. The reason, from what I have understand or from what I can see, I think we were in the cage uh-huh. in Saddam's time uh-huh. because there was no technology whatsoever. Like even no TV. We had only uh-huh. one or two channels in TV. That's it. You don't have any other we didn't have any other choices.
And were those channels largely propaganda or were they?
Those channels were 100% with Saddam's
his
influence.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Program. Yeah.
What he wanted to watch.
Yes. And a lot of times people were saying, if your TV broke, you can put Saddam's picture there. It would be the same.
That's great.
Yeah. So even though, I was saying that you couldn't tell uh-huh. that in your own family, you are uh-huh. afraid your kid's going to go outside to talk and uh-huh. someone hears about them and uh-huh. then they come to hurt you. Anyway, uh-huh. that's a different story.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind me asking, how did you get the job with the Army? I mean, did they have an ad in the paper? Or?
See, that was interesting. I have my nephew. They have like a real estate offices in uh-huh. Kirkuk. And this guy came there. He was in the same school with me. But we didn't know each other very well. So he was coming to buy land and stuff like that. He got money. So he then my nephew asked him. He was like, what's your job? What do you do? He was like, I'm an interpreter with the U.S. Army. He was like, oh wow, really? My nephew was telling him that I'm interested to work with the U.S. Army, and mm-hmm.
And this wasn't your idea.
It was my idea, but I was, as I said, I was just graduated. Uh-huh. So, but I helped U.S. Army a lot of times. We were going back and forth to school because the school was about 4 hours away from mm-hmm. my hometown. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times there was checkpoints. Uh-huh. And I remember a couple times they stopped the bus mm-hmm. I was in. They were asking people who can speak English.
Ah.
So I went down a couple times on the bus and speak with them. And people were like, going by, were like, wow, you can speak English? I was like, It was not like now. It was a broken English. But because I never had experience to uh-huh. speak like with a native speaker, uh-huh. even though we studied English all our in the study, right. in the school. So
that's how you got discovered.
So yeah, that guy told my nephew, we really need people to be there with us in Saddam's palace. And he was a Kurdish. He was like, I don't know, I love to some Kurdish people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like more trust between U.S. Army and Kurdish than any other. I'm not trying to be racist, but that's something.
There's a history there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I went there. I got an interview. I got accepted. I went through some kind of tests, essays to read it, mm-hmm. to ask some questions. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, back to the point, like I remember the Humvees were just like, exactly like convertible. Like there was nothing, no protecting.
Really?
There was like, I remember I was wearing in the beginning, because like with my civilian clothes, I'm being on the Humvee with the U.S. Army. And at the end of the day, when we went going back to the base, take a cab, go back to the transit system, uh-huh. you know, from transportation system, to take a bus and go back home and go the next day, same thing. It was so interesting. There was no attacks, no IEDs, no Qaeda or whatever those people can call themselves. And I think the reason is, as I said, is to... People were very interested to see this force come from outside. Mm-hmm. People never saw those kind of people, mm-hmm. even on TV. And the second part, which is the most important part, whoever was loyal to Saddam and his army and his system, they were paranoid and they were so scared to be united again.
I see.
So it took time for them to realize, oh, we need to fight back. So after 2005, then all the situation changed.
Became worse. Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted you to give an example of a typical operation that you were involved in when you were a translator.
Normally, there's two ways to go hunt the bad guys mm-hmm. or take them down. Sometimes they are, as a military, they plan ahead and they have information and they know those bad guys. They have activities in certain areas and they know where they live. So they make themselves prepare and they go there. And sometimes it's just like the force, they call it QRF, Quick Reaction Force. Which is those for sometimes if there's like there are emergencies or, you know, the bad guys are over there for a certain time and after that they're going to run away and you cannot get them or you don't have a lot of information about them. So they were sent their QRF forces. But normally we were just like having information in the villages that we have the people on the villages, they were like cooperating with us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not all of them, but there were some of them that were cooperating. So... they were sending like with the other, they call it the S2 department, or just the intelligence part. They were gathering information, the names and everything, and the numbers, how many people are there. So that information was going to the big league, like the commanders, and then we were planning to go there with help with either Iraqi army or the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. So there was just like a joint meeting between two sides. When I say two sides, like U.S. forces and Iraqi side, mm-hmm. army or Peshmerga. The leaders, they were just like the commanders, I mean. They were meeting and going through details and how we go out and what time we go there. And normally we were going there, like going to hunt the bad guys down.
the helicopters were going ahead of us, just in case if they knew they were coming, we were coming, they run away. And a lot of times there, we had those technique in the army. They all the like the cell phone services would not be working anymore. That way they don't call each other and they run away.
Jamming, I think they call it.
Kind of jamming, yeah.
Did you sit in on these meetings?
Oh yeah. I was a translator. I was like doing like meetings with the army side and meetings with the when we were sometimes going like with the to meet with the governors and the mayors and the cities or the town or the small towns too.
The American soldiers, were they trained a little bit in how to speak the local dialects?
Not really. Because I feel like it's because of the wartime, and there was getting deployed from here and go there, and there was not a lot of time. But some of them, they got like learned from interaction between the interpreters, and they would just have fun to know the language to say some couple words. But most of the like the commanders that I work for, I taught them like couple words of Kurdish, you know, or Arabics, you know, just like kind of you have a better communication when you say when you meet someone and you speak with their language, and even if it's a couple words, they you get their attention to you.
I would think in an operation, especially something that could be dangerous, mm-hmm. that you would want to know a few words, like
right,
like I'm your friend, or
right, yeah,
move that way, or
yeah, or I'm not here to hurt you,
right, right,
such and
yeah,
such,
or get your head down, or
yeah.
Nabas next began to talk about some of the specific military operations he was involved in.
There's a lot of good and bad stuff in my memory. One of the horrific things we saw, we went to raid a village with the Peshmerga, which is the Kurdish forces. We went there, and the villages around that village, they knew that U.S. Army with Peshmerga going to get the tourists or bad guys. We got information there's some people over there they wanted on the list.
Right.
So they start attacking us with rocket, and that was very, very scary because you don't know where's your enemy. You just there's rockets falling everywhere. We found a big hill. And we laid down and we just like on being on the ground to protect ourselves first. Uh-huh. And then we contact some of our guys to get air support and to get rid of where those rockets, of the sources of the rockets.
Now, did they train you militarily at all? Like give you some?
No.
Oh, man. So you just were following everybody else?
I was following, but I had my own gun with me. So,
okay, so you had protection and some...
Oh, no. I went... After the situation got worse in 2007, if you were seeing me, you didn't know who was interpreter, who was U.S. Army. I was wearing, the exact full gear. You would not notice it at all. Right. Unless you were just, seeing the name tag that it says U.S. Army, then it says interpreter. Other stories we had done there... we were doing a lot of visits, as I said, for the villages and especially for the schools and make the people, like the army, and we are here for help, not for hurt you or kill you.
So you're kind of public relations, maybe.
Oh yeah, okay. A lot. Uh-huh. So we were going to a lot of elementary schools. Mm-hmm. We're going to those villages and give the kids a lot of gifts, and they were very surprised. And when I was talking with them with Arabic, they're like, "Wow, you gonna speak Arabic?" I was like, "I'm Iraqi. I'm from here." They were so happy to see that. I remember one time, it was middle of the night, we were in the base, and we had some coalition for U.S. Army with Peshmerga went to the patrolling, and this guy, he was a very old guy with the Peshmerga forces, he got hit by IED, and they brought it in, and I was interpreting in the middle of the night to... We didn't have, the military base was not very big, so we waited for a helicopter to come all the way from another city to pick it up. And he was, but he was very, very brave. He was like, "I don't care even if I die, because I know what I'm doing." Yeah, that was it was very touching for me.
How bad was he hurt?
He was hurt really bad, really? From his hip, because mm-hmm. he got like a metal cut him. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did he live, do you know?
He lived. Okay. Yeah. One of the other incidents that happened, I had a friend of mine. He was an Arab guy, and he was from those bad villages, but he was with the U.S. Army. He was a very good guy. He got, I think, 4 or 5 kids. We worked together for about a year or a half, and then I moved to another military base, mm-hmm. And he moved to somewhere else. But then later on, I heard from my friends, the tourists in his village, mm-hmm. they got into his house, they killed him and I think he was his wife too. Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
so they found out he was on the American side.
Yes, yeah. We were more targeted than anyone else.
Oh, because you're considered turncoats?
Yes.
I see.
Next, Nabas spoke about some of the relationships he developed with American soldiers.
I have a lot of friends, but the most important or the fun group that I have, mid-team, they call it a mid-team, they I'd work with, their base was in New York, but they were not originally from New York. Uh-huh. But I had really good relation with literally every single one in the group. And till now, we are friends on the Facebook. Uh-huh. And a friend of mine, he was a captain back then in the U.S. Army, and he was in charge of the interpreters. So I remember because they trusted me a lot to a point when he came back home during a vacation or 2 weeks vacation, he did not put another U.S. officer to cover him. He put me to take care of the interpreters until I came back home. Their military base moved to Texas. But when I moved here, they come all the way to Tennessee to visit me. Oh, wow. Driving all the way from Texas.
Oh, that's great. What are some fun things that you guys did when you weren't?
Oh, the fun thing, we were in a military base, or they call it a FOB, Forward Operation Base. Part of the base was Americans, which is we used to live there. And the other part was a Kurdish Peshmerga. And we used to, literally every night, me and the commander I used to work with, we're going to visit the Kurdish side, the Peshmerga, their commander, and eating a Kurdish food there, even though we had our American food in the chow hall. Huh. Served for
was
free.
The Kurdish food better, you think, than the Army food?
I think it is better.
Because most Army guys complain about the food.
Yeah, I think the food is not... Yeah, I think the Kurdish food is better. It's because of fresh.
Right.
Yeah, it's fresh. That's the point. And it's a different.
Right.
So... We were like literally every night or every other night, we were going there, eat with them all together, and then we go to the commander's room and watch TV and talk about the situation, the politics, even the history. It was really, really fun. After we moved, like the military team moved and they replaced it with another team, they were just like losing their real brothers. Oh, but yeah, they were so sad. Yeah. Like on both sides, because you go to fight and shoulder to shoulder to each other. You take care of each other, no matter where are you from.
Mm. You saw these guys under pressure, obviously.
Yes.
When you go into a military situation. Were they different people when they went into battle?
I had not this team that I mentioned earlier, because I was like with different team, and there's another team we're going. They were MP, they call it the military police. Those people kinda, they were not nice when they go outside. And that was really bad. And the United States Army realized that after a while. They were really not nice and tough to people, and they realized people were not like that. And they are not insurgents, but just because of the way they act with people, they make them to
bad public relations.
Very, yeah. So I remember, like, they went to a raid to a couple of villages, and they came back. They were I did not know about that because I was not working with them, but a friend of mine, he was an interpreter, he was with them, and he was happy about it, which is make me more like upset. He said he went to the houses and he got like cell phones and money.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah, and he says they couldn't say anything.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I was like, you should not let that happen. Right. He was like, I can't do anything. I was like, you can do. You can report it to his commander.
Because it could mean his death later on if you create
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And that's, yeah, that's, I mean, when you say army, it's just like there's different people in it.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
But back to your, the guys that you like, when they went into a dangerous situation, mm-hmm. can you describe how they were?
The guys I was with, they are really organized. If we were going to, through a dangerous situation, we were just like keeping in touch to each other always. And they really took care of me. The commander that I was working with, he was just like, you don't move anywhere. You just stay behind me. Yeah, so he was good group.
There's been some films recently, a few films about the Iraq war and the Afghani war. Do you ever watch those, or are you would rather not see them?
I watch them. They're really poor quality, even Hollywood ones.
Oh, really? So yes. They're inaccurate.
They are not accurate at all, because for someone, if you are. If you never visited Iraq, you would feel like the people or the way people lives in Iraq, they all wearing flip-flops, or there's no even shoes to wear, right. And there's all camels everywhere. I just don't know why a big corporation like Hollywood don't realize...
Can't get it right?
It's not even can get it right. Like, you're talking about, I don't know about Afghanistan. I don't want to talk about Afghanistan, right. Because I don't have a good background information about it. But as from Iraq was like in, not now, but back in the days, one of the, like Baghdad was like, they called Baghdad is the capital of the world because that much
You mean recently or back in history?
Back in history.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but like what I'm trying to say, if a country was... has a really deep, rich history. That thing still gonna stay with the people. It's true, back when the like people went through a very hard time with Saddam, and but there's like
I think you mean civilization.
Yeah. The civilized mind. You know.
Right. Now that's a good question. It's a bit of a political question. When you see reports, I can relate it to this. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in China, someone sent me a report. I think it was NPR about China, mm-hmm. and I thought that person. It doesn't sound like they've been here, or it sounds like I don't know what part of China they're talking about, but it's certainly not where I was.
Right.
And I was really astounded about how inaccurate the report was. Do you, when you see news reports here or on TV or on the internet, do you get that sometimes?
I get that a lot. I got that 2 days ago. I listened to President Obama's speech, and he was talking about like how Iraqi, the thing, I even told my wife, I was like, I just don't know why they can't say it, because I don't know if you are aware of or not, it's been over a month, like there was a very hot fight where I'm originally from, Kirkuk, mm-hmm. and Peshmerga doing an incredible achievement there. 2 days ago, I was listening to this Kurdish news, and they were saying there were over 600 ISIS trying to attack Kirkuk to control it like a Mosul, but Peshmerga did not let them. Like they literally hand all of them down. Plus, by help of coalition forces of Iran City's Air Force. But the day that the incident happened, it was in a foggy day. They used that way the airplanes cannot hunt them down. But the Peshmerga was just like, they're really like a metal barrier. What I'm trying to say here, when President Obama was talking, it was like, by the help of Iraqi forces, ISIS being pushed down, which is, I don't feel that's accurate enough or true enough, because to be specific, Peshmerga did all of that. Because Iraqi army left the biggest province in Iraq, which is Mosul, and then half of Tikrit, Saddam's hometown.
You think it's political that he's trying to?
I think it is political.
Trying to give Iraqi forces more credit.
I think it's a lot behind it. But as a Kurdish, I don't like it.
Of course, yeah. Well, because, as someone who wants the truth.
Yes, you need to hear the truth, and you need to hear like you know what happened in Kobani, like mm-hmm. that small town, the Kurdish residents, they broke ISIS. Yeah,
yeah, everybody took up arms, even the women and the...
I read this article. There's a guy, his name is Musa. They call it Musa Sniper in mm-hmm. Kobani. He says he did not lost one bullet. He was a sniper. He killed over 200 ISIS members.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
They need to make a movie about him.
Yeah.
back to kind of more political questions. Do you ever meet people here in America that obviously are ignorant about what's going on in Iraq, and because of politics, they've taken a position?
Yes.
And of course, they don't know. They only know what they know from the internet or from the TV. And does it break your heart sometimes?
I did. I met a guy from, I believe, D.C. or Connecticut. I told you, when I went back to teach in this international school, and he was there. There was a lot of Americans. Mm-hmm. So he was talking about like how the Americans come to Iraq and destroyed Iraq. So it was.
And he was in Kirkuk.
He was in Kurdistan, in Suleimania.
Kurdistan, okay.
In Suleimania, which it was only an hour and a half away.
So he was unaware of all the stuff before, all the stuff that Saddam had done.
Yes, yeah, and he was really like, he was like kind of reading books always, and he was kind of like, if you look at him, he was like, wow, this guy is reading a lot, and he's an educated guy. But I told him, you don't know what you're talking about. He was like, no, we came here, we destroyed Iraq. I was like, no, you don't know that, you don't see the whole picture. The freedom is not free.
There's a funny song about that. But
you haven't heard about what happened to Kurdish people during Saddam's time. Like 5,000 people died with chemical in a matter of 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then the process of, they call it Anfal process, they exactly killed 182,000 Kurdish people. In all the different age ranges, like they were just like, put them on the shovels, was digging holes, put them there and cover them alive. If you come out, you get killed with his army. Yeah. I was like, you don't realize that.
When you talk to this guy and you obviously could back it up with information, did he ever come around? Or
he did. He changed. He knew he was wrong, because I even told him, it's not only about Kurdish. I don't want to even talk about Kurdish. Mm-hmm. As overall, like, tons of people, he realized that, because after a while he was like, I was not aware.
Well, that's saying something, because some people, you can show them all the evidence in the world and they'll still either they believe or they're just so loyal to their political party.
I feel like especially for a country like U.S. because I'm American, mm-hmm. and in we have like a strong reputation in the world too, in every way, in economic, in education. Like for you to be coming from a country like this, you need to analyze stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be like a sheep and you just have a shepherd takes you wherever he or she wants. Yeah. Yeah, you need to ask and analyze.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a problem. And I mean, there's many explanations for why.
Right.
Again, I go back to China a lot, where they, you know, the government wanted robots. They wanted no one to question them. They wanted people to do what they're told. And it's a problem, because no one can think for themselves. No one can fix problems, critical thinking. And it's happening here. Again, there's multitude of reasons, but it's pitiful.
Right, it is.
Considering freedom and entrepreneurship and science and, you
know. Right.
Yeah.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be there by 4:30 because I made your reservation. Don't be slow.
So how did Mr. Cotter end up in Tennessee?
When I got a special visa from on behalf of U.S. Army and the U.S. government, as a loyal to the government and the U.S., I was free to choose wherever I left. I have a couple of friends of mine. We were in the army together. He was an officer in the U.S. Army. He was a captain. He used to live in New York, so I was planning to live in New York. And then after a while, his military base changed. He went to Texas. So he was like, I'm living there. If you want to come there, you are welcome. I would be, you know, accommodating you for the, you know, for the beginning. And I was like, it's all the same to me, so why not? Then a friend of mine, he was an interpreter. He was like, I'm going to go to Nashville. Why don't you go with me too? That way we know each other and we've been friends in the army together.
Now, was he Kurd or?
He was a Kurd. Okay. And in fact, I was with him like before I met you. I was with him this morning.
Okay, great. Yeah. So you're still friends.
Yes. Yeah. He was from Hawler, from the capital, Erbil.
Okay.
So he was like, I'm going to go to Nashville. I would like you to come with me. That way we know each other and we can take care of each other in the beginning. I was like, okay. with saying that, I never knew there's a Kurdish in Nashville.
Really?
I did not know that.
Okay.
I really did not expect to see this amount of Kurdish in Nashville.
Yeah, were you shocked, I guess?
I kinda. Like, I really kinda. I was like, wow, what is going on here? Like,
conspiracy of Kurds in Nashville.
Yeah, I did not expect that. Like,
so you had never, in Kirkuk, you had never heard of Nashville, Tennessee?
No.
Okay.
And the reason is because, not because I was not researching, and not because I'm not, as I say, till 2004, believe it or not, I never used the internet. And right now, like when I use typing in laptop or anything, like even my wife, she was like, "What? From what you have experienced in your life, you are really like if I type or do anything." I'm a grad student, by the way, in MTSU, and I'm teaching engineering lab right now. So like it's a big jump in the life between, let's say, before 2003 and after 2003. Uh-huh. Because, you know, it's a big difference when you grow up with the computer and you can type with it. You know, I graduated from engineering school and we did not have a chance to even practice on a computer. Wow.
So you're old school engineer then?
Yes.
And how did Nabiz settle into his new life?
When I first got here, there's these two organizations normally in Tennessee, in Nashville, World Relief and Catholic Charities. They help refugees to settle and so on.
Okay.
So even though I did not really need it, but it was, that's part of the process. So I was with World Relief. They came and picked me up from the airport, and I sat with this guy. He was from Iraq too, for I think 2 months or so on. Then I found a job and I worked as a security officer in downtown, and then later on I helped the I worked as a volunteer with World Relief to help the refugees to resettle and help them with this medical screening, filling job applications, and so on.
Mr. Cotter has acclimated so well to Tennessee culture, he scored himself a nice Southern girl.
I was helping this family, they are from Kirkuk too, to, even though they were here before me, but they were not good in speaking the language. So I was helping the head of the family, the dad, to go to, you know, to some offices and applying for a job, or they having sometimes, you know, questions or problems in the school for his kids. I was going with him, like helping him out. He told me that there's a girl, American girl, in his house helping his wife and his daughter to learn English and so on, and teaching them English. I was like, wow, that's nice.
Now she, could she speak Kurdish?
No. She could speak a little Kurdish and a little bit of Arabic. A little bit. So I met her in their house. We become friends, and we were going to that house together a lot of times because we were helping. Then we become friends for about a couple years. Stuff like kind of developed from there.
Right. You've taken her back home.
Yes.
Right? And how did that go?
She really liked it. Mm-hmm. And my family, they were just like, really, really liked her.
Okay.
And when we came back from there, being there for a year and a half, when we came back, I did not expect that. Like, when I said goodbye to my family, it was normal. Mm-hmm. But when she said goodbye to my family, to my mom and sisters, they were crying a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, it was so, like, I was like, it kind of makes me happy too, how they love each other.
Right.
But she really likes my family. Like, a lot of times she really misses them.
And her family?
I'm their son.
Okay, great.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have a baby on the way?
Yes, we do.
What does Kurdistan look like now since Mr. Hussein assumed room temperature?
First of all, you would see a lot of foreign people.
Foreign people?
Yes.
Okay, so they're pouring in. Why?
Because of the stability over there.
Okay.
There's a good economy, there's jobs, and people are welcomed there. And there is no conflict or war or even like kidnapping and assassinations okay. for foreign peoples.
There. So if someone listening to this wants to invest, they...
I would definitely recommend that. When I was there with my wife, we got a job to teach for the international school. Mm-hmm. I was a math teacher and my wife, so she was an English teacher. Mm-hmm. I remember in Christmas when we came back, the airplane in Sulaymaniyah when we flew back here, I think 90% of the passengers, they were Americans and Europeans. I really shocked.
Wow.
I was like it made me happy.
This is the end of part one of my interview with Mr. Kaderer. Now move on over to part two.